Hello, welcome, and thank you for joining us in the Restorative Lens podcast, where we bring together voices in the restorative justice community to share insight, practices, and perspective.
Each series of the Restorative Lens will be focusing on different topics within the field of restorative justice and give a space to hear from those who are most directly impacted or involved in the work.
The Restorative Lens is supported under the National Center on Restorative Justice, and we are your hosts. I am Tomei Douglas.
And I am Alana Ojibwe. We're so excited to share with you the launch of this first series, which features the voices of several authors from the book Colorizing Restorative Justice. Colorizing Restorative Justice is a collection of 18 different essays by 20 practitioners and scholars of color, exploring the issues of racism and colonization within the field of restorative justice and restorative practices.
We hope you enjoy listening.
Good morning, Tomei.
Hello, Alana. It's nice to be with you.
It's great to see your face. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing good. Doing good. I'm excited for our first episode, episode number one, launching this podcast.
Yes.
So exciting. to finally be launching.
Right. I'm excited about our first guest. So can you dive right in and tell us who that is?
Yeah, so exciting. We were able to talk with Rochelle Arms Almengor and hear a little bit more about her chapter in Colorizing Restorative Justice, which focused on women colorizing restorative justice in white-led institutions.
Wow. That sounds like it's going to be good. And I look forward. Thank you so much to our listeners again. And Rochelle, we are excited to have you here. So why don't you just introduce yourself and we'll take it from there.
So, yeah, my name is Rochelle Arms Almengor. My last names are reflective of my ancestry and heritage. I'm mixed race, mixed culturally. My father comes from English and German stock immigrants to the United States, starting as early as the 18th century. And my mother is Panamanian mestizo, on the indigenous side from the Nobe Bugle tribe in the mountains of Panama. And, on the Spanish side, we're not sure, but I grew up in the area where this indigenous group is prominent. So my upbringing was in an indigenous setting, very small town and community, and experiencing a lot of the, I guess, code switching and navigating that I learned from a very young age between very many different kinds of people. And, you know, had notions built into me pretty quickly about who was more important than other people. And, you know, all of that has played into my own sense of identity and also recreating my identity, finding myself again over time as an adult and understanding all the influences I had as a child. So that's my, you know, like what makes me up in terms of culture and sense of self at a core level. I am a professor, an assistant professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. I teach in the sociology department, but I'm not a sociologist. I teach dispute resolution or conflict resolution. I also teach restorative justice to students, to undergraduate students who are doing a certificate or a minor in dispute resolution at the college. And then most of my work experience has actually been as a practitioner. So I was a mediator and a restorative practitioner since the late 90s. You know, I really got started in college through a practicum in one of my courses that exposed me to restorative justice, and then have been just really lucky that it opened doors for me, you know, that whole experience I always say more than anything, what I got from college was was learning about conflict resolution and restorative practices, because it really paved the way for so many opportunities that have shaped my life in the last 20 years. So yeah, I've worked with homicide offenders, you know, early on in my career, doing restorative justice seminars in Kentucky. I've worked in India and Argentina around conflict and sort of collaborative processes amongst different types of groups, including indigenous groups in Argentina. And I've worked predominantly, my sort of real cutting of the teeth happened in New York City, working in a large nonprofit mediation center and starting a restorative justice program there that received cases from the district attorney's office in Brooklyn to be mediated. But, you know, we turned it into sort of what's now called restorative mediation. So it's sort of a hybrid between the mediation process, but with this restorative orientation, given the high level of volatility and pain, sensitivity that parties in these situations carried, mostly minor assault types of cases between people who knew each other or were family to each other. So that's my trajectory.
Thank you for sharing that. So I have a question. Because again, you are highlighting, of course, the book is colorizing restorative justice, but you highlighted Black practitioners. So can you just speak to why that was your focus?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's I think always been very clear to me that there isn't one experience right for people of color. And that's why we have this BIPOC terminology now. You know, we're really trying to differentiate that the Black and the Indigenous experience is different from people of color. And what does people of color mean anyway? You know, it's such a broad term and it can encompass a lot of privilege. You know, certainly there are people of color who have been raised in situations of perhaps much more privilege relative to their own environments than people in, you know, like Appalachia, Eastern Kentucky, for example, with white skin. But there's also a history that we cannot ignore that needs to be raised up again and again because it hasn't been dealt with, which is the legacy of slavery in the United States. And it is such a unique history for that has just never been reconciled, you know, for a country that prides itself on freedom and equality and, you know, anybody can make it and all of that sort of American dream nonsense ethos that we know doesn't play out in reality. It comes down the hardest on African American communities in this country. And so, as I said in the chapter, you know, schools, which is the setting of where we interviewed these Black female practitioners, are really the microcosms of the larger society. So what you see happening on the outside, you will see happening on the inside in a school setting, except it's really amplified because there's no hiding. You know, everybody can see what's going on. It's a tight-knit community. It's ripe for gossip and miscommunication, as well as quick communication. Students and the other way around, you know, everybody's paying really close attention to what everybody is doing. Judgments are rampant. It's like a pressure cooker of all of the situations that happen out there in the world. So the fact that these practitioners that I highlighted in the chapter were still, you know, experiencing the same kinds of challenges that they experience as Black women walking through the world in terms of needing needing to insist on their point of view as mattering, you know, needing to insist on certain settings, like with the practitioner whose boss would come in and sort of, you know, take over the meetings and silence her in a way that was really minimizing and disrespectful of her own place in that community. Those are things that were not new in those women's experience, you know, but they followed them. And the reason why the chapter matters, the reason why this whole book matters is because, well, many reasons, but one in particular is that restorative justice as a field aims to do better. It aims to be better than that. You know, it is the philosophy that's about inclusion, that's about hearing everybody's voice. It's about everybody belongs in the space. Everybody belongs in the circle. And so when within a context that is aspiring to do that, that's promoting itself and gaining leverage by standing up as sort of the place where that's going to happen. And then even there are these major blind spots and it's not happening. Then we really have a reckoning to do. And restorative justice as a field is unfortunately not immune to those blind spots.
I love that it was a quote from one of the case studies when they were talking about the experience in schools and how, you know, not only institutional leaders, but even white colleagues and people that even in an institution that is for and in support of restorative justice. And this is so great. We have this program and, you know, seemingly, and I think often well-intentioned in support of the idea. But then, you know, what was the quote? It was a wolf dressed as a sheep or something where, mm-hmm. you know, it can almost be more damaging when it, the philosophy is in, you know, something that's in the language, but not necessarily in the practice in how people actually engage with those students and promote the engagement with those, you know, practitioners of color. And it's not something that is practiced, you know, at that entire level. So it's, it's interesting when you talk about, you know, the voice and when someone is asked to use your voice, which also comes up in the chapter about, you know, how often those practitioners of color are asked to connect with a student because they, you know, get it more or can speak on behalf of what's the perspective of all mm-hmm. Black people and what's the perspective of all Indigenous people and, you know, how problematic that can be. But then in other settings, asked to silence their voice if they're, you know, not if their supervisor is present or so if you could.
I mean, the issue of tokenization is really huge. It's something that I observed in my work settings. And it's, you know, I mean, I think we all have blind spots. I think that that's just a human quality, and that's why it matters that we be humble, you know, and that we be open and we listen to each other to see what is coming across that we aren't seeing that we're putting out there. And I think unfortunately a lot of work settings don't even make the space or even have it in consciousness. The leadership doesn't even have it in their consciousness that making the space to ask those questions and have that conversation is necessary. And so the conversations go by the wayside, the experiences go by the wayside. A person who's a lower rank in an organization who's concerned, you know, as Jasmine was in this chapter, concerned about keeping a job, you know, and putting food on the table, isn't going to be in this luxurious position of speaking out all the time. Mm-hmm. And there are examples of women and practitioners who do, and I think you have some good examples of that in the book. But it isn't fair to expect that when there are those risks to take in this sort of structure that you're trying to exist in, that if you're feeling more vulnerable, you're feeling slighted, you're feeling overlooked, not just feeling, but are being overlooked in spaces of power and power play, and, you know, that you should be the one to speak out. And it's sort of the narrative we've been hearing for so long around the new cry for social racial justice, the educating that BIPOC communities continue to try to do and sometimes throw up our hands about for white people, you know, like, we shouldn't be the ones to have to tell you this. You need to do that. You need to realize that you are, you know, taking space in these ways, and choose of your own accord, because you understand that it's not right. You understand that it isn't the way you want to be. You understand that you need to make the space, and you need to be the one to ask the questions, and you need to be the one to be curious and educate yourself, you know. So, but because it just doesn't happen. There's something about being in positions of power and then being part of a community where you never had to experience the same kind of disenfranchisement or exclusion that BIPOC individuals have experienced and do experience every day, that renders that kind of a blind spot. And so, so yeah, what you were saying, Alana, about wolf in sheep's clothing, which is what Carol's words, you know, is that when you have people in charge who are saying, and as what I've written a lot about through my dissertation some years ago, but the espoused values, values of restorative justice are very much contrary to some of the things that you actually see in the practice of leaders and teachers, administrators in schools, unfortunately, and that creates a further harm that's even worse than the original harm in some ways. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Thank you for that. That was so, it was so important for me to even hear you explain, respond to Alana in that way, because when Alana was initially asking the question and she was describing things, I felt like she was describing my experience, you know, working as a restorative justice coordinator in school systems where, you know, they want me to talk to the Black person. You know, and when I finally paid attention to what was happening, because it was a pattern, you know, I just pushed back and I said, why are you asking me to speak to this student? Mm-hmm. And they really couldn't give me an answer, you know, because they knew why, they just didn't want to speak to it in that moment. And then it was another situation where there was another white practitioner. And we were doing some type of presentation, and after like the white trainers finished, she was like, that was so excellent. That was well done and blah, blah, blah. And we just kept going. And then the next time I had to present, and when I sat down, she's like, you go, girl, you know, and I didn't know her. Right. So we didn't have like this relationship. We didn't know each other. So it was like, why the you go, girl, you know? What was that? And I actually had a conversation with her about it. And she said she wasn't aware that she did that with all the other trainers. She kept saying, great job. You did a wonderful job and blah, blah, blah. Until she got to me and she's like, you go, girl. You know, I'm like, what's that? What does that mean? You know, explain.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So it, and it's one of the reasons why I love your chapter, because you speak to even what I'm researching, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of how white educators are actually perpetuating harm with Black children in the school system, mm-hmm. you know, because they're not even aware of their own biases or willing to engage this process in a meaningful way. And I'm referring to restorative justice.
Mm. That's so, so good. I didn't know that's what you were focusing on, Tomei. So that's good to hear about. And I was going to say, so one thing, we need more research in this area. We need more people to write about it, to bring it to light, to make it a buzz conversation, you know, around all of the sort of high profile forums around restorative justice. So it's excellent that you all are giving it attention, that you're putting the spotlight on the book and all of the themes that it brings up. And hopefully it'll have that impact throughout the practitioner community. I would say, you know, a lot of practitioners are you, Tomei, you know, like I was going to say too, you are somebody who should be interviewed for this series in a way too, because these experiences are your own. And I wanted to also mention our other work together, because Tomei and I are part of this participatory action research group called the Restorative Roots Collaborative. And so often in that group, which is composed not just of people of color, but people who identify with some underrepresented community. And we're all restorative justice practitioners, and we're basically delving into talking about issues that are difficult for us in our work. And a lot of our conversations, right, Tomei, have been very similar to the stuff that is in colorizing, that there's a lot of parallels there. So the book has been, I think, validating for the experience of that group, but also so many other, you know, this came up for me because I had so many informal conversations mm-hmm. with practitioners like Tomei and many other friends, colleagues who were going through this similar experience. And it was like a hush hush behind the scenes conversation. Like, you know, I can trust you to tell you this is what I'm feeling at work. This is what I'm feeling around my bosses or whatever, who just don't get it. And so to bring it to light, to give it validity as something that can be spoken out, and it I think is really important. And and yeah, so much of the education really, I think, needs to happen for those doing the front lines work, so that, you know, we can understand what's happening with us in those settings when something doesn't feel right. Mm-hmm. But really, this education is about accountability for leadership of RJ programs, trainers who are, you know, cycling out new practitioners all the time and are getting all these contracts to do so. And people within these institutions who are bringing in that expertise and wanting to sort of make it a checkbox versus mm-hmm. a real deep process of transformation.
So I have a question on that for either one of you, because I have thoughts on this as well after, Rochelle, I had prior to my role here at VLS in the National Center, I was working actually also at high schools in Brooklyn. And very similar experiences in a lot of ways, both with students and coworkers and institutional levels. So I really am curious what if either of you were in a role of say a director or a principal or whoever a hiring body may be at one of these schools. I really liked in the book you mentioned about, you know, changing the narrative and what we see in leadership. And there's so many skills that I think are so clear to people who understand the needs of youth of color, what those kinds of
skills that someone who's in those leadership roles should have to understand them and to support them. But often, you know, there may be a disconnect with what that institution sees as valuable or leadership type qualifications. So if you were in those positions, what would you say, what are some of the top, what's top three that you'd be looking for in someone to say, it's really important that someone who's working with our youth in these schools that are predominantly students of color, what are top three skills that they should have, you know, to really be a good leader in those positions?
So, Rochelle, I'll let you answer that one first.
I want to hear from you too. As long as you also answer.
I will answer, but okay. I want to make sure as our guest that you get the first dibs on answering.
So you're talking about leaders in schools. What are the qualities that they need to have? Alana, that's your question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in thinking specifically about women of color and what those skills are that oftentimes they possess already and are doing already, what are the things that you wish a resume could reflect more accurately to put those, you know, to match them in those positions of leadership? What are some of those? I guess, you know, oftentimes I think about how much they get phrased as soft skills that are really some of the most difficult skills, I think, for someone to have. And so what are you think those important skills that specifically RJ?
I think RJ said, I work both in the mediation world and the restorative justice, restorative practices world. And while there's some similarities, there's definitely a difference, I think, in what makes a good practitioner in either of those. And I think, you know, in the mediation world, conflict resolution, we often focus on you have the skills, you can do the work, you know, like you learned the process, you are really familiar, you've done it lots of times, and so you can do the work. And I think restorative justice has been more explicit, and certainly the affinity that I have with practitioners I spend time with, you know, we would agree that there is an explicit need for you to actually walk the talk of these values, you know, that you be the person that you are trying to support other people in being. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, another one of the many isms in our society, but certainly in schools, is adultism, you know, where there's this notion that adults are better and they have more knowledge and therefore are more important members of a community. And their voices count more than children's voices. I think it's very easy for us to sort of, I don't know about practitioners of color. That's certainly not the experience that I've had in connecting with other practitioners of color, but certainly leadership that we're talking about, I'm talking about in this chapter, and the women in the chapter commenting about, fall into this kind of in-group of the adults in the school, you know, who just sort of talk to each other about the kids and put them down and, you know, insult them behind the scenes. And obviously that's not everyone, but there is enough of it happening that there's almost a culture of acceptance and not calling it out, you know, when it happens. So I think anybody who goes into a position like this needs to be somebody who's going to be, unfortunately, because there's a lack of support and so much of the work is uphill right now, somewhat thick-skinned. but also with a capacity to value themselves, to know their worth sufficiently to be able to interrupt the cycles of oppression that are happening in all of these environments, but definitely in schools. I think it's, like I said before, I think it's an unfair and a tall order. And so I guess your question maybe, I guess I would say, you know, having the experience that many students experience, which is what a lot of the practitioners have. They come from communities that are similar to students, at least in the big cities. That's who we're seeing doing the front lines work. Mm-hmm. Already qualifies you to such a degree. You know, like that's already so much more credentialing than that you went to a training, you know, by Kay Prannis. Mm-hmm. It's important that you be able to get it. It's important that when you express presence and empathy, that it's authentic, that you're not just trying to drum it up and sort of imagine what it might feel like. It's important that you can hold a space and understand to some degree what the pain is on all sides, you know, not just bring people together and say, okay, you did this, and mm-hmm. I'm gonna look at my book and follow the steps of a good circle process, you know, and we'll be done and everybody goes their separate ways, but that you be somebody who can actually relate and carry some of that experience. Those are my thoughts off the cuff, and I could think about it more, but what do you think, Tomei, having been and training too? I know you're also training school.
Yeah. So, I don't think what I would consider an important quality, it would be something that can translate on a resume. I'll just start out with that. Mm-hmm. Because for me, it's, they would need to have heart. And I say heart because they would need to, one, have the capacity to do their own work, so they can be critically aware of and reflective of how they engage the world through their lens based off of their experiences and how it influenced their behavior and what they perceive from other people. So that's one layer of having heart. But then the other part of having heart is to be able to acknowledge when you're wrong, you know, and going into what Rochelle said about adultism, I do find that, and it baffles me all the time. Like, why do we expect our young people to cognitively process information the way we would? We're adults and their brains are not even fully developed. So why do we have this high expectation from them to do something that biologically they can't do? You know, they don't have the capacity to sit and say, you know what, let me think what would happen tomorrow if I respond in this way. No, it's an impulsivity that just is natural to them. And for those young people who appear to be really immature, that's a blessed thing. You know, I'm happy for them. But for the others that are usually labeled and considered troublemakers, and then they eventually have a stigma on them in the school system, because it's like, that's the bad kid. That's the one who always act up. But it's really being able to sit back and say, why am I expecting something that biologically isn't happening? That's one. Two, why do I think I'm the expert on this person's life, even though they're 15 or 16 or even 12? Why do I think I'm the expert on their life and I need to tell them how to live and what to do without engaging them? Because it's a process of community. So restorative justice is about building community, making these meaningful connections. But we don't want to do that. And then we want people to just respond to whatever call to action we give them. You know, like we're these robots, You know, we're just going, okay, this is what you want. This is what I'll produce. No, it's engage. So have the heart to realize you don't know everything. You can be wrong, and that children can teach you. So I don't know how that would like translate on a resume. And then the other place to have heart is to be able to speak up for yourself and to call things out. You know, like when I shared in that earlier story, I called that out, you know, and even when I did a racial healing circle earlier this year, and somebody reached out to me in between the circle and they said, listen, I'm thinking maybe I don't belong in this circle. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, let's meet and we can unpack it. And when we met, they were everything they explained to me. And I said, oh, okay, so this is what we call white fragility. You know, so to be able to name that, which everyone is not like people are tiptoeing around, but doing it in a way where it's still, it might be harsh to someone on the other end, but, you know, we can't grow in a comfortable space. You know, uncomfortability is where we grow. So that's heart. That's my thing. So I'll have to come back and think about that too, how that can translate into a resume.
I love that. I love the way you put it. I think that's the crux of it is heart on so many levels, both the meaning of heart as courage, you know, to speak up and speak out, but also just to feel, you know, to be able to feel and get it and have a connection that's deep with the people that you're working with, to love, you know, quite simply to love your students, to love, even the people who don't get it, right. Which can be the hard part. But yeah.
And love self first.
Yes.
You know, I think that's right. It because it's like, how can we give what we don't have?
Yeah.
If I don't love myself, then I don't have the capacity to love you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yeah. Alana, we are like right at our time. this is similar to our interview with Desiree.
No.
Desiree,
it still feels like we could go into another 3 hours easily.
Right. But I just want to say thank you, Rochelle, because I appreciate your book. I'm excited just talking to you and knowing that I can actually cite you in my work, but
and I'll cite you too someday. Yeah.
Towards the end of the book, your chapter rather, you asked some questions, and I really felt like they were right in your face, right? Just putting it in your face, a call to action. And I feel like you have taken steps with RRC. You know, with the Restorative Roots Collaborative, you have created a space for, like you said, marginalized persons of color to be able to amplify their voices. And so I just want to say thank you for that. And Alana, if you had any last comments you wanted to say to Rochelle before we close out.
I so much appreciate, again, you know, and I think, to echo Tomei, the chapter, I hope that people read every part of this book, but, you know, I think in particular, a lot of the chapters, and yours included, have like very tangible calls to action about what people can do with this education and, you know, implementing it in settings that apply to their own work in, you know, whether that's in restorative justice or not. I think this is so necessary to speak to the experiences of so many different, you know, settings and environments. And so I just really appreciate your work, really appreciate talking with you, and hope we can continue this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you all for the opportunity. And I look forward to hearing the finished product of this and all of your other interviews. Yeah, I'm sure it's tough to put an end to some of the conversation.
Huh? It is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fun. Well, thank you for the chance. And
thank you so much for your time.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for taking time to be here with us today. And we hope you stay tuned for our next episode. And for more information about Colorizing Restorative Justice or contacting the authors or learning more about the National Center on Restorative Justice and our partner organizations, please go and check out the link in our bio.
This project is supported by grant number 2020-MUCX-K001, awarded by the Bureau of Justice Assistance. The Bureau of Justice Assistance is a component of the U.S. Department of Justice's Office of Justice Programs, which also includes the Bureau of Justice Statistics, the National Institute of Justice, the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, the Office for Crimes, Victims of Crime, and the Smart Office. Points of view, images, or opinions in this document and are those of the author do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice.